we get you set up with a wonderful seminar. We've been talking a little bit about sustainability. Most of you have visited an Oregon winery yesterday, and you've seen firsthand some of the application of vineyards here in Oregon, and I'm sure you've encountered some people from all around the world that grow Pinot Noir and gave you a little bit of a feel of what they do with Pinot Noir and in the subject of sustainability as well. So, but we're going to try to dig a little bit deeper into it today, and we have two wonderful seminars set up for you this morning. But I'm going to pass the microphone right away to Andrea, that you've met already, Andrea Robinson. And she's going to take us through the two seminars. So enjoy.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you've been having a great festival so far. Yeah? You're all here. That's good. Today is Be Really, Really Sweet to Your Sommelier and Your Vintner Day. And as you can see, we've now enjoyed 24 hours of the very best part of the wine industry, which is the giving nature of the vintners and the sommeliers that have it as part of their livelihood to enhance our pleasure and to and be of service to us in a setting like this. And so at the same time, you know, they too do it for the pleasure of enjoying the product with their drinking buddies. And so they still have a lot of work to do while we sort of get to sit around and enjoy it. And I think really every day should be nice to your sommelier day, because you all know that there are many, many benefits to that, right? So this is a thank you to the sommeliers and vintners. Not too loud of applause, because they may have a headache. no, I'm just kidding. Really excited about this topic. We had a fantastic seminar yesterday, and I think yesterday was Group B in here, and are you guys technically Group A? Okay. It was a fantastic seminar. We're going to be dividing it into two sections. The first section will explore the concept of sustainability through the eyes of a single, very famous domain in Burgundy, the Domaine des Comtes Lafon, with Dominique Lafon, and his comments will be fine, filtered, and facilitated by Burgundy dude Jasper Morris. And a couple of years ago when I was here at the IPNC, I proposed a certain, I think a voting on something. And in any case, it was something that was in the realm of competition. And I thought they'd never invite me back, because one thing the IPNC doesn't do is competitions. However, I would like to propose a competition today between Group B and Group A, because I know that after 24 hours of Pinot Noir, you guys will be a lot more creative than the other guys. And the creativity that we're looking for is the title to Jasper Morris's forthcoming Burgundy book. We have the subtitle. It's perfect. The subtitle is The Sex Life of Burgundy. So we need the super title. And I only got one suggestion from yesterday's group. It was a pretty good one. So put your thinking cap on and beat it. Vertical shoot position. Okay? All right. The masculine side of Burgundy. Okay. So that's for you to be thinking about. But more importantly, it's time for you to be thinking about sustainability. And the typical vernacular, the current mode for that, the definition of that, I think is specifically around the idea of an approach to farming that minimizes inputs that may have a negative effect on the environment primarily. But today I'd also like you to think about it in terms of sustainability of quality. Impact on quality and sustainability of quality. And we're going to be thinking about quality in the context both of wine and of life. Okay? Quality of wine, quality of life. And when you think about those two things, you almost remove the concept of sacrifice from the equation. And you simply redefine that as trade-offs, alternatives, choices. So we'll talk about and explore the path to those choices through the eyes, first of all, of Dominique Lafon, and as facilitated by Jasper, because we have an extraordinary vertical tasting to take us on that trip. So we get to hear, see, listen, and do, and follow that path. And then the second section will allow us to explore the same concepts through the eyes of a panel of celebrity vintners that I'll introduce when we start that. So let's get going.
Thank you, Andrea. Good morning, everybody. have to say that quality of life is feeling pretty good at the moment. Quality of wine last night felt very good. Quality of my voice this morning, a little lower than I would like it to be. Never mind. We'll press on. So, back in 1981, I became a wine importer in the UK, and I went around the various regions, and towards the end of the year, I got to Burgundy for the first time, and I must have lucked out in some way or other, because the first place I tasted at and the first vigneron who I met was Dominique Lafont. And we stayed friends ever since, and I've had the opportunity to look at his wines, originally his father's wines, and then his wines over the last 25-plus years. So it's a great pleasure to be up here today with Dominique. We're getting a little bit nervous as 9:30 came up, and there was no Dominique, and I thought I was going to have to try a bogus French accent and be both halves of the equation. Frederick Lafarge very kindly offered to stand in for Dominique, but happily, he made it.
At 9:30,
true. So I'm just going to sort of warm Dominique up. We fed him some port last night to make sure he would be on good form today, and get him talking. And then every so often, if he looks as though he's going to run down, I will intervene and spur him on the way. So Dominique, tell us a little bit about the background of the domain.
Okay. Good morning. You'll be surprised. I'm not going to fall apart. And first thing about sustainability, which you find directly on the way you are this morning, is that wines produced this way doesn't hurt you, even if you drink a little bit too much. That's a personal feeling, but I think you can try that and be in good shape next morning. Yes, I'm from Burgundy, Meursault, and my family has owned this property, Domaine des Comtes Lafont. It's fourth generation, so it started with my great-grandfather, who married a woman from Meursault who had some a little bit of vineyards, and my great-grandfather was a wealthy lawyer and a collector, art collector, and I think back at that time when you didn't make any money with vineyards and wine, it was not famous as it is now. I think he bought all these beautiful vineyards. It took him 20 years to do all that just as a collector and to have great vineyards and nice wines to drink with his friends. That was fancy life, I think, at the time. So anyway, that's how it's been built. It's 14 hectares, which translates into, I think, 35 acres of vineyard. We produce 14 different wines because we have all these small appellations. Production is roughly a third of Pinot Noir, mostly out of Volnay. Major vineyard is Volnay Centenot, and I also produce Volnay Champagne, Volnay Clos des Chênes, tiny bit, because the Clos des Chênes is like 4 barrels a year. And I have a nice piece also of a less known vineyard in Montlis. It's a first growth also. Montlis is just nearby Volnay. And then a big chunk of, I'm sorry for that, of Chardonnay out of Meursault and a little bit of Montrachet. Anyway, to be short on the history, the domain passed by generations with good luck and bad luck. It depended on who was running it. And also there's been two wars in between, and it's been very strong on what could happen and how the vineyard would be run and the money you could make out of the vineyards. My father arrived at the domain in 1956, and it was a hard time for Burgundy, also for business. He was an engineer, and he kept a system which had been set a long time ago, which is sharecropping. So we had people working the vineyards for us, and we used to get half the crop, and they would keep the other half crop for themselves. And he ran this the estate like this up until 1982, 84. Nobody knows now. When we decided to take over the vineyards, so we stopped this contract and started taking care of the vineyards in 1987. That's when I arrived, actually.
Yeah, I think you should clarify this a little bit, Dominique, because you say your father retired in 1982, and you arrived at the domain in 1987 or 84. What happened in 83?
That's a good question. Yes, well, Pierre Moret was part of the sharecropper. No, the joke is that in between, I started working with my father. I studied oenology and viticulture, and I was actually in Oregon in 81, right after my studies, and in California. But I stayed in California and traveled to Oregon at that time. And I get back around 82 and help my father. And there was a decision to take over. But then arrived the 83 vintage, which was a terrible vintage for quality of the grapes, and there was botrytis and all that. It was a difficult vintage to make. And with time, we find out that my father says, I haven't made this vintage, my son has made it, and I always say, my father was responsible for the vintage. So nobody has done this vintage.
I think that might be an indication, if you happen to see some coming up at auction, don't buy the Lafond 83s.
Yes, that's good advice.
Right, so you took over then in the middle of the 1980s.
Yeah.
And what were the farming practices at that time?
Well, at that time when I took over, there was a lot of different practices because we had nine person taking care of the vineyards. One of them is a famous person. It's Pierre Moret. But I had other growers also doing it in Volnay and other places. So they all had different ways of cultivation. But at that time, anyway, most of what was done in Burgundy was, because it was modern, using weed killers and using chemical fertilizers and all these things. And I think my generation, which includes Fred Lafarge and Jean-Louis, who is here, and I would mention my old friends, Christophe Roumier and Étienne Griveaux and Pascal Marchand, and we all thought about what was going on and the quality of the wines and that we had to do a change. And I think we all moved toward that direction of a cleaner agriculture, of not using these chemical fertilizers and then stopping the weed killers and all that. And should I say what happened to me?
Please.
actually, that was... when I took over, I started like this. I started with these chemicals and all that, and it was very interesting to see that you have all these merchants selling you these products, and if you have like a disease or whatever, they tell you, oh, apply this one, it's going to work. And it works, but not exactly well. So then they come back and tell you, oh, we have a stronger product. This one works really well, and it's more expensive, and you apply it, and you don't have satisfaction. And then you also realize that you poison your life, you poison your family, and all that. And I realized, and I think it's really true, that the more you try to fight with nature, and even all the pests and all that, it gets resistance. So you have to fight more and more, and it's like it has no end. So I think we had to go backward for that. And so I became interested with organic cultivation, and it took me like three years to change all this.
So when was that?
That was 89 is when I really realized we should change things, and I would say by 91, 92 it was run organic. And in the meantime I paid visit to some growers who started using biodynamic techniques, and looking at the vineyards, it was very interesting. It was the vineyard looked better in terms of growth, and so we ran experiment with biodynamic in 1995 on 1 hectare, and moved the experiment quickly to 3 hectares, and so we arrived in the end of 1997. I had run 3 years experiment, and with good success on the vineyards. They look healthier. It worked well. And so the question was, can you apply these weird techniques of biodynamic you know, because you have to dance with the moon at night and do all kinds of weird things. That's what you hear about biodynamics, isn't it? And actually, it's much more simple than this. But the question was, can you apply it on a large scale, and then it's worth doing it, or is it just like for fun and to tell your importers and clients that you're doing biodynamics, so it's kind of fancy and fun? And actually, we decided to go for the entire estate. We had to simplify a few things, like I stopped dancing at night naked when there was full moon, or things like this. And actually, biodynamics is just applying, to me, it's just applying a few products which you make, which is horn manure and horn silice, and a few plant extract like nettles, like horsetail, and you can apply lots of other things just as long as you understand and you get a good feeling with the plant.
Does it take a lot more time than organic farming, or cost more?
Well, out of our 14 hectares, I calculated that, and it's 100 hours more work a year, so it's not that much. And actually, what is the most difficult, but it's a lot of fun. It takes you into what's happening in your environment around the vines. To be simple, I would say that biodynamics requires you to understand what's going on around your vines, and you take into account things like the soil, the plant, the air around, the light, the wind, the heat, these things. You have to get a good feeling for that, and up to the sun, the moon, the stars, because there are planets' influences also. And so you can move from planets to your vineyards, or start from your vineyards and then look at the planets. And what is important is to have a good feeling for what's going on around your cultivation.
And so do the vines, the vineyards, actually look different, feel different after your change to biodynamics?
They do a great deal. When I started and experimented, I remember because Fred Lafarge is here with us today. I mentioned to Frédéric I was running an experiment of biodynamics, and if he could have a look at the vineyard and tell me what he thinks. And it's visually impressive. And I remember when we talked together about it. This vineyard was in the Volnay-Sorteau, the wine you're tasting here today, and it was getting old. It had lots of virus. It was not growing. We had miserable crops in that vineyard, and actually in 3 years' time it became much better. It grew better, and we got more crop, which is also one of these stupid things people say, like you grow organic and you do biodynamics, so you're going to have less crop. It's not true, because it's a good system. It's another system for agriculture, but it doesn't mean you lose crop. It's because your vines become healthier. So then you can choose to have a big crop or a smaller crop, but it's not going to hurt your vines. They're in good health afterward.
But did you have any difficult times in the transition period, any really horrible vintages when everything attacked you?
This, I think the most difficult part is changing from chemical agriculture to organic viticulture. Because you have to understand that when you take over vineyards which have been cultivated with all these chemicals and fertilizers, they're like these Tour de France guys, you know, like this. And all of a sudden you take the shot out, and they have to manage and find their way. And it takes a bit of time, and for all the vineyards it's a bit hard. And I think in that way of doing things, actually biodynamics helps a lot. The major problem is when you start plowing again vineyards which haven't been plowed for years, they develop superficial roots, and you start plowing and you cut these roots, And it's like, oh my God, what am I going to eat? Because there's no fertilizers anymore, so you have to get your soil start again to feed your vines. And the 500 preparation helps a great deal to get better roots, deeper roots, and to get a great activity in the soil to feed your vines. So I've done this transition in Meursault from chemical to organic, and the three first years, it was a little bit difficult for some vineyards because of that. And then I applied Biodynamy, and it went back. And actually, my experience with another vineyard I run now in down in Mâcon, where I started from chemical in 99 to Biodynamy in 2001. So it's been very quick because I was trained for that, and it worked perfectly well. And I think applying organic and Biodynamy together is a great help to do that transition.
So that's the vineyards, and as it comes into the wines themselves, do you do anything particularly in the cellar during either vinification or the maturation that reflects biodynamics?
Not that much. I would like on that point to say that every time we talk about organic wine, it actually, by law, it doesn't exist. What you're drinking is wines made out of organically cultivated grapes. There's no rules for wine production being organic or whatever. So we can use the same techniques than a normal producer. I think what happens when you move in that direction, you get better grapes, you get better ripeness, you get better balance, you get better acidity, you get better flavors. So I changed my winemaking techniques being more simple because I didn't need to have to extract as much as I used to. And if you extract in a lighter way, you just take the good things, you take the better things. If you push extraction a bit further, which was also in fashion in Burgundy in the 90s, where there was a bit more big wines, big Pinot Noir, maybe some also wine writers pushed us in that direction, but we quickly realized that Pinot Noir has to be, it's an elegant grape, it has to be elegant wines, so you don't want to go for too much extraction, you want to go for great grapes with great flavors and be very gentle with it, and this is how I do. The only thing we play around with, and with absolutely no understanding at the moment, is play with the moons and planet situations for racking, for bottling the wines and all that. And we've run a fair amount of experiment because we have a group, a working group for biodynamy. We're all the other guys here are part of the group. So we share experiment and we meet very often for vineyard works and also in terms of winemaking. And I remember, it's another secret for you today, we wanted to run experiment on bottling, and on the biodynamic calendar, there are some days which are, how you say, pointillé? It's bad phases of the moon. I don't know.
Lunar knots, but that doesn't mean...
Yes, lunar either. Knots. And it's supposed to be not that good to do things in the vineyards these days. And next to it, there was a beautiful constellation, planets, situation, which we call fruit days, which we work a lot the vineyards on these days because we know it has a very good impulse on the vines. So the goal was, because that's what I'm doing also most of the time, to bottle that wine, most of that wine, on that fruit day, which is a beautiful biodynamic day, and then bottle like, I think 36 bottles on that nut day, just to see the difference. And I've done that, and it's no secret. It's the Meursault, straight Meursault 2001. And 2 years after bottling, we all gathered, and there was other experiment run about bottling, different dates. And it was blind, and with friends, Benjamin, who was here, I remember also. And we tasted these wines, and actually that's when I found out I had 10,000 bottles which were not tasting as well as the 36. So, at the end of the meeting, we decided we had to run more experiment, it's complicated. This part is very complicated. It's fun. What you realize also is that it has a very strong effect these days, and that's how you feel planets have something to do with your life, the wine, and all these things. Maybe
got a question.
Already? You're not supposed to ask questions. What? Oh, no. Biodynamy. 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 It's a system.
Okay.
I don't use products.
Okay. I think... Right. We're going to get bogged down in this. Look... We're going to get bogged down, I think, in too much detail. We've only got another... Yeah. Yeah. Brief.
Quickly?
Yes.
Okay. Biodynamy is a system which has been worked by someone called Rudolf Steiner back in the 1920s. And it's complicated, but this guy had the feeling that... first of all, planets and things like this had a lot to do with agriculture, and that he could invent a new way of cultivating, which is using plants, which is only using these whole manures and things like this. It has nothing... I cannot find my words. C'est pas rationnel dans son.
It's not a logical.
It's not a logical thing which you can really prove, saying on a paper, this you do this and it works like this. But then, if you apply it, it kind of does something. When I'm telling you these fruit days or different days with planet positions makes a difference in the bottling, it's true because I saw it. If we apply, for example, on the silice, horned silice, we apply it 4 grams per hectare, and you see it on the shoots of the vine. They grow differently after. So if I get into that and give you a lecture on biodynamics, it's going to take a long, long time, and it's as simple as it's complicated to explain how it works, and maybe it's not what we should do today.
I think, in fact, we're going to need to get on and start looking at the wines. Good news is Dominique has mentioned that fruit days are particularly suitable for cultivation of wine and indeed for tasting of wine, and the organisers of IPNC have very cunningly organised that both yesterday and today are fruit days. So, well planned. Congratulations. So we have 5 wines in front of us. Those of you who are being particularly observant this morning will have noticed that one of them is white. That's just to ease you gently into this morning's tasting. In one sense, they're all from the same vineyard, because the white wine is a Meursault, which in the Lafont family has the name of Désiré. They've always called this plot Désiré, but in fact it's in the Meursault Centenot vineyard. And if they wanted, they could call it Premier Cru Centenot, Meursault Centenot, but just for their own family traditions, they stick with Meursault Désiré, in which case it's not allowed to be called Premier Cru. And most of the Centenot vineyard is actually planted with Pinot Noir, and as a courtesy title, even though it exists in Meursault, it's called Volnay Centenot, since Volnay is a red wine village and Meursault is white. So we then have a little vertical tasting of 4 vintages of the Volnay Centenot, and the Lafond plot is in the best bit, you'll be pleased to hear, which is the middle part, the Centenot du Milieu. So what I suggest we do is we'll taste the white wine and then we'll have a look at the 4 reds. So just break off for a minute and start tasting.
Good break.
Yeah. You finished yours already?
Yeah. No.
That's
the
wrong glass.
No. Cheers.
Hmm. So while you're tasting, I'll just ask Dominique to say one or two things about this particular vineyard, age of vines, and so on, soil.
Okay. Actually, this vineyard is now pulled out and replaced. So last vintage was 2005. The vineyard was really getting old, and even with I've done a lot of work with biodynamic on this vineyard, but with not enough success. It was it had a lot of virus, too much virus, too strong, and so I hate to do that, but I had to put it out in 2005. It's been run. It's one of the first vineyards I started also doing applied biodynamic because I wanted to help this vineyard to turn healthier. So I started biodynamic on this one in 1996. So there's 4 years of applying these techniques on this wine. 2000 vintage for me was a fun, great vintage to work for Chardonnays. We'll see that there's a Pinot Noir from the 2000 vintage later. And actually that year, Volnay got hit by strong rain and hail just before harvest, the day before. And so we had to pick the Pinot Noir very quickly. And there was no rain and no hail on all the Chardonnay vineyard side. So we picked later and in perfect condition. And to me, it really reflects what can be done in Burgundy with Chardonnay. It's got a nice acid. Maybe it's high acid for some of you for your standards, but I think it's a cool climate wine. So it has a certain pH and acidity, which brings freshness to the wine and makes it drinkable. As Jasper said yesterday, it's a magnum for me every day.
Absolutely.
No, I'm joking. But
I think my experience sort of from the outside and also knowing the Lafon wines over 25 years, I have seen a change in how the wines taste since he moved to biodynamic farming. And in particular, I would say three things. The wines have an enhanced purity, and this absolutely is a very, very pure example. They have greater minerality, which is, as I mentioned yesterday, the wicked wine merchants that when we buy wine, our tasting notes talk about acidity, and when we sell it, we talk about minerality. but there is a difference. I mean, acidity is measurable, and minerality is more a stylistic thing, a bit of a flavor profile, a bit of texture. And the third thing is that I have found with the Lafon wines is that the precise vineyard definition is clearer and more focused since we moved to biodynamics. And in fact, I found that with every other producer where I've been able to see the wines both before and after. But that this is a very fresh Meursault. It's, 8 years old now, but it still seems pretty young to me. Got plenty of life ahead of it.
Well, you have to know when these English guys comment the wines, they like their white wines very, very old, much yes. older than anybody would drink these wines.
Yes. Yeah, obviously you have to mention the decade, but in the UK it's advisable to mention the century as well when you're talking about the...
And about the point of being more precise on each of the vineyard, it's really something you find out when you start even just working organic... organically, because when you use all these chemicals on the soil and when you feed your vines with nitrogen and potassium and all these things, the wines reflect more of your ability to grow grapes and your skill in winemaking, but they don't reflect where they come from. You have to find this junction between your plant and the soil and the area. And It's as I told you before, when you do like this, it doesn't reflect anything but what you put in your vines. So making 14 different wines from 14 different vineyards, appellations, premier cru vineyards, that's the first thing you see, which is very encouraging when you go in that direction, is that your each wine becomes more typical of each vineyard. So it's very satisfying.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about the Volnay-Sontenot vineyard before we taste the reds, your holding of it.
Okay. The Volnay-Sontenot du Milieu is one part of the total Volnay-Sontenot area, which I think is 20 hectares. 20 hectares would be 50 acres total. That's all the Volnay-Sontenot would be 50 acres. It's shared in Burgundy into a lot of growers because we all have small pieces. I have the chance to have almost 4 hectares in the best part of the Volnay-Sontenot, which is called Sontenot du Milieu. And this part total is 8 hectares, which is, 20 acres. And I have half of it, which is very rare, actually, those days, to have almost 4 hectares of the same vineyard, which I think for red grapes is a great help because I work with 3 or 4 big tanks of Pinot Noir, and I actually don't like... I think it's more tricky to vinify small lots. It's much harder to ferment. So I have 3 fermenters of 20 barrels each. And I think fermentation goes better in big volume. Then if you move to larger volume, it becomes difficult also, but small volume are much harder to handle.
So we have 4 vintages, and the first 2 are dramatic contrasts. It used to be the case that only one vintage every century was a harvest that started in August, 1976, 1893, 1719, and so on. But it's becoming more common. And the 2003, the harvest began around about the... I think the very first person started picking on the 12th of August, so about a month ahead of a normal, very early start. And the 04 was picked in October, so it was a late season, a cool season, a little bit rainy. And if we start with the negatives before we come to the positives, there are many wines in Burgundy in 04 which are light and very herbaceous. And in 03, there are wines which are, some of them, definitely sunburned, heavy, with some pretty aggressive tannins. And those people who acidified in 03 because the acidity levels were very low, we've seen some of those tannins and the acid combining into real enamel stripping jobs. But Dominique, I think, has managed to do something significantly better than either of those suggestions with his 2 wines. So if you want to taste the 04 and the 03, love that perfume on the nose of the 04.
04, actually, we're not that lucky in Volnay. We get hail very often, and so that was hail also in August before harvest, so which is always a bit more difficult than to make the wine because you have to do a lot of sorting, and when you have hail in August, you lose part of the leaves, so the ripeness might be more difficult, and I think on that part of ripeness, we've had a chance with weather. It worked well. I think at that time, also, we all were well trained with all these new techniques of organic cultivation and all that. And with Frédéric, we both applied clay powder in powder on the vineyard, which really dries the botrytis, so you get healthier grapes afterward at picking. And that, I think, saved a lot of the crop doing that.
Yeah. Lovely freshness to it. Excellent minerality, genuinely minerality, in that wine. And then look at the 03 alongside.
If you, I looked at Jasper watching colors of these wines, and actually for Burgundy standards, the Volnay-Sontenot always tend to produce darker wines than, for example, I get much lighter color in the Claude Chen vineyard. It's an area which is heavy clay with limestone underneath, but it's heavy clay. It's early ripening, and it's always darker than the other red wines I produce year after year. And I'm not looking for color. I'm not doing anything special to get dark color. It's just like this.
Something which stands out quite clearly to me with this pair of wines is that the 04 is about a fruit acid balance and the 03 is about a fruit tannin balance. But in both cases, they strike me as very balanced wines, and I love the way the tannins are folded into the fruit there. Did you have to do things differently in 03?
That was a good question when harvest arrived, and actually the date of harvest surprised a lot of us. So we always take a little bit of vacation in August, and we had to run back home, prepare the cellar in 3 days, and really rush, and at the same time think about what are we going to do with this very ripe and very early vintage. And we're very good friends around Burgundy, so we talk to each other. And I would like to mention Frédéric Lafarge's father, which who I went to visit, because he's the old guy in the Côte de Beaune. Maybe your father has 50 vintages? 50, hein? He's made 50 vintages, so he knows a lot. So when you're a bit younger, you want to see the old guys to know what they think. And so I talked to Michel about that special vintage, and I said, well, what do you think, Michel? Well, maybe I feel like I don't think I'm going to do any pigage. I want to do pumping over because I don't want to extract too much tannins.
Pigage is punching down,
punching
by the way.
Down. Because I think there's going to be so much tannins in these wines, and I don't want to make rough wines. I want to work toward the fruit, more on the fruit and on the lightness, because there's going to be so much extract. And also, my thinking was fermenting a bit lower in temperature also, just to get more in the fruit direction. So for the technically, I didn't want to go over 28, 29 degrees centigrade, which is pretty cool for fermenting. We usually go up 32, high would be 34. And Michel Lafarge shaked his head and he said, well, Dominique, I think it's a great idea. Why don't you come back in 3 days' time when we talk more about it? Because I'm not that sure. So it was puzzling. And what's amazing with this vintage is that I think we should now meet together at that point and share our wines and share our experiences, because there's a lot to learn from this vintage, because everybody took different positions, picking late, picking very early, doing pigage, doing exactly the same way, or like Jasper said, some acidified, some didn't, some... It went in all kinds of direction because it was a very special vintage. And I think we could learn a lot from going back on the wine, tasting together and sharing.
So now we move on to the 2000 vintage. We had the white wine, and Dominique mentioned yesterday that the rainfall didn't fall in Meursault, but in Volnay and Pommard and points further south, there was an incredible downpour. And it was 12th of September, just absolutely the skies opened, and I can't remember how much, was it a litre of water or something?
70 millimetres of water. Of water. Oh. The day before harvest. That's fun. With hail. So actually the grapes were smashed a little bit and it was warm because it was early in the season. 13th of September is early. And the risk then when your grapes are hit by hail, some of the berries are opened, so the juice falls out of the berries. And if it's warm, botrytis, it's like this. It takes 2 or 3 days. So we really had to rush to pick these grapes.
But no taste of rot in that. Nice, very gentle. I think probably coming into its perfect drinkability period now.
It's always been, I think it actually, we would have made more powerful wines without that heavy rain. But the vintage turned into a very elegant style of Pinot Noir, which I think actually is also very stylish of a red Burgundy. Red Burgundy shouldn't be too heavy, and they should be more on the elegance side than on the power. And this is what we're getting with that 2000 wine. And also it's showing well today, as Jasper mentions. It's good to drink. I think it can still age also. Mm-hmm. You can keep it maybe 10 years. It's hard to guess, but it's still fresh. Yeah. But it's good to drink. I drink a lot of that now.
And what about the 97? How long would you keep the 97, which is a very sunny year? Warm southern wind blew pretty much throughout September, no rainfall at all.
I don't know. The vintage has been good from start, and everybody said it's never going to age. So I think I'm going to keep it as long as I have bottles, and we drink a lot of it. So it's the problem with some wines, when people ask you, how long should I keep, how long is it going to age? But some wines are so good, young, that you finish the pile and you never know how long they will age.
Yes, exactly.
Because they're good, so you drink them.
Exactly.
It hasn't moved that much in bottle, but it's ready also, and maybe if you forget a bottle.
Yes.
You know, we've all had, I hope you've had some of these very, very old red Burgundies, which are 30, 40 years old, 50, 60 years old. And it's impressive all the time. If you drink at 29 or whatever, we don't do that very often, you know, there's not that many left. But it's impressive.
I think Dominique is angling for an invitation to come back again and bring with him. I think we'll do the 29, the 59, and else. Anyway.
No, but everybody says Burgundy doesn't age. It's wrong.
Yep.
It's wrong. They age beautifully, and you can drink a very,
exactly.
very, very old Pinot Noir. And it's not because it's big that it's going to age well. It's because it's balanced, and it will keep as an elegant wine for a long time. The only thing is that you need a decent cellar to
yes.
get these wines to age beautifully.
And it won't age once you pull the cork out. We're running out of time here, so I think if you've had a chance to taste these absolutely beautiful wines, you can see a theme of the vineyard character running through them all. Clearly also quite noticeable differences from one vintage to the next. But it just remains really for me to thank Dominique for a really beautiful exposition of what he's been up to at the Domaine and for these five lovely wines. Dominique, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dominique has one more thing to do today. I checked in the biodynamic calendar, and there is a particular crossing of planets in the right way, and he's going to lead us in a bit of naked dancing during the salmon bake. So we look forward to that.
Sometime,
the even better news is that I won't take part in that.
Sometimes it brings the rain. Are we going to take a question, or do we have time for questions?
Do we have time for take a question?
Yeah.
Yeah. The question was, what percentage of new French oak is used in Dominique's wines?
It depends on the wine. For the Vonnet Centenaire you tasted, there's roughly a third new oak, and then a third is 1 or 2 years old barrel, and a third is old barrels. For the white wine you tasted, there's no new oak at all. There's 1 and 2 years old barrels. I don't want to make wine that smells of new oak. I want to make wine that smells of fruit, Pinot, and that smell of where they come from. So we use new oak, but in the final result, I don't want it to. I don't want you to feel that new oak flavors.
Talk about your approach to alcohol and the alcohol level in each wine.
I would say most of the time in Burgundy, in the Côte de Beaune and the Centenaire, which is a nice ripening place, I would say 90% of the time, you pick grapes, they are like in between 12.6, 12.7% alcohol to, when it's very high, 13.5. And that's where we are generally. Actually, the 2004 is a bit higher in alcohol than the 2003. It's like more toward the 13.5% alcohol. It has to do with the hair, and I think we get concentration in the grapes, and it moved very fast. 2003, I remember, is natural 13.2% alcohol. But maybe you have a higher feeling for alcohol because there's less acidity, and that this component with acidity and alcohol gives you different feelings. 2000, I would say, in the glass, 12.8% alcohol, which I think if you can achieve ripe grapes with lower alcohol, it's beautiful because it makes lighter wine and it's easier to drink. And 97 is more natural alcohol, 13.5, which I think is, in Burgundy, it's the limit of ripeness before you turn to over-ripeness most of the time.
Okay, perhaps one more question, then we better wrap it up.
What percentage of whole clusters do you use?
I can answer that one. Somewhere between none and...
No, well, I don't use all cluster system. I distem all my wines. But, starting with the 97 vintage, so all these wines are made with the same machine. I changed my distemmer, and actually I think in the tank I get 80% of whole berries. And I'm really trying to do a work toward with these whole berries. So the more I go, the less I do pigeage at the beginning because I do a kind of a cold soak. I don't touch the grapes because I really want to work that whole berry system, which really brings a nice fruit and a nice feeling to the wine. Brings you less aggressive tannins also. So the more I go, the more I just do pigeage in the heart of fermentation, which is like 3 or 4 days, and I don't do pigeage at all in the beginning, and I'm very careful about doing pigeage at the end of fermentation also. And total fermentation is roughly 3 weeks, roughly. But if you do long maceration like this, you have to be very kind on the grapes and on the skins.
Great. So we will now make our transition to our next section. Let me thank Jasper Morris and Dominique Lafon. Fantastic seminar. And as we transition to our next panel, I'll just point out a point that Dominique has made in talking to us about this. And one thing that he mentioned yesterday is that and it played off of something that Ted Castile, who will be coming to the stage along with the rest of our panelists, and please come on up when you're ready, that it's the sustainability is a path rather than a destination. I think that's something that Ted said, and Dominique had already discussed that the next sort of the next cycle or the next phase of his path was looking beyond the vineyard and to the rest of the aspects of sustainability, including the energy usage and water impact in the winery and in the process. So not just simply first exploring organic and how you treat the vineyards, but then biodynamic, but then a subsequent look at, all right, what is the impact and the sustainability of how we run our winery and how we build our buildings and how we insulate them and so on. So as we bring our celebrity vintners to the stage, please come on up, guys. We're going to expand our horizons a little bit and see several different pathways towards and approaches to sustainability. And while we're making this transition, both in wines and personnel, I'm going to just take a stab at the organic and biodynamic sort of I won't say definition, but a little bit of illumination around them. And I'm not the expert in this, so I'm going to oversimplify, but for the purposes of the group, I think we shouldn't make the assumption that everybody sort of gets it and understands what those things are and the differences. And at a very simplified level, which I think our panelists will be able to illuminate, organic is simply, it eschews and forbids the use of synthetic inputs. So there still may be commercial products such as fertilizers that are organic, but they don't come from synthetically produced ingredients or components. So that's a big part of it. And as contrasted to or as illuminated upon by the idea of biodynamics, and I think where the confusion was is that the French word for it is biodynamie, which easily does sound, especially at this hour, like vitamin E, right? Seriously. I mean, that was an okay, you know, thing to confuse. So biodynamie or biodynamics is an approach that, as Dominique was pointing out, was taken from some studies and papers and talks by Rudolf Steiner, who is really more a philosopher. But what it does is it looks at the farm as a whole, and it utilizes preparations that are natural, preferably derived from plants and animals that are raised on the farm. But there's debate as to, you know, not everybody necessarily is able to accomplish that completely. But very often those preparations are put together as compost-type teas, where they take the nettles or the silica and mix them as a suspension into water and spray the plants with those. Sometimes the dancing in the vineyard piece of it comes from the fact that some of the preparations are made after burying the core ingredient in a cow horn in the vineyard for a certain phase of time. So it's interesting. It's quite interesting. But I think the most exciting aspect of it to me, aside from the fact that it is all natural and it does look at the farm as a whole in much the way that we need to look at our bodies and our health as a whole, is that it is something that vintners, you heard it from Dominique and I've heard it from many others, do because they see the impact in the health of their vines and in the quality of the wine. So if there's any true version of sustainability without sacrifice, it has to be something like that where you can say, it makes my wine better, it makes my vineyard healthier. You can't go wrong there. So round two of the competition. And I didn't get any notes passed to me with ideas for Jasper's book, so it may remain untitled. Oh, we got one over there. She's going to share it with us. Endless orgasms. Okay, spoken like a woman. All right, we got a couple. Yes. Debbie does terroir. Debbie does terroir, spoken like a man. All right. I'm going to take two more. And then we'll introduce our panelists. We have one back here. Only behind a Geneva double curtain. Spoken like a very gracious man. Very cool. And over here, I'll give it to the lady in brown. The erroneous zones, okay. What? Anticlimactique. Nice, okay. The rest of them, write it on a note and pass them up, and if we have time during Q&A, we'll come back to you. What? Okay. All right, but that was round... He's not going to write the book now. Jasper is giving it up. He'll change his mind after the naked dancing this evening, because we'll recalibrate his viewpoint. Okay, second round of the competition is that yesterday, due to a severe lack of Pinot ingestion on my part, I a couple of times referred to Frédéric Lafarge as Dominique, right? Because we had Dominique first, and then I called him Dominique Lafarge instead of Frédéric. And so once we got that squared away, I decided that if I was going to screw up his name, I should screw up everybody else's. And so we developed a celebrity alter ego for every member of the panel. So rather than tell you what they are, I'm going to make you guess, okay? So this is round two of the competition. Ted Castile, to my right from Bethel Heights, is our first panelist. And your hint is he uses the force of nature. Hint two, episode four. Come on, hang with me here. Yoda. All right, competition's over. I'll just give you the answers. Hand puppets, crayons, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Thank you. I said episode four, not Liam Neeson, but the other guy. Okay. Ted Castile from Bethel Heights. I never could come up with one for Frederic, so in the tradition of Madonna and Cher, he is just simply Fred. All right? He is a celebrity in his own right. Okay. And then we have Ted Lemon from Literai Wines. And If you vinify it, they will come. Kevin Costner, yes, you're back in the game. You're back in the game. Sweet. Okay. And then we have Nigel Greening. He is not a virgin. I don't know if this is a fact or not, but that's your hint. Madonna. What? Okay, he likes to fly in planes and balloons. Very good, Richard Branson, yes. I mean, what's his name? Is that right, Richard Branson? Yeah, okay, good. All right, and finally, Elvis. Yes, I was going to say he's checked into the Heartbreak Hotel of Pinot Noir Vintners. And you got it, Elvis Presley. My first cut at it was a young Johnny Cash, but I think Elvis is the one. Good job, guys. All right, you now get to have some wine. So what we have poured, let's see where, oh, good, we get to start at the beginning with Fred, and he will take us a little bit through the sustainability question and pathway from the perspective of his domain and his wine. And as we go through, gentlemen, I'd like to ask that you take part of your time on the panel, your initial comments, to also take us through a description of the wine so that people can taste with you and taste what you're tasting or look for what you're tasting. All right. Fred. Fred.
Good morning. I am a lucky wine grower, and in the 60s and at the beginning of the 70s, all the consultants said, for your wine, it's necessary to put fertilizer and potassium. Michel, my father, was wise. He said, my wines are in good health, my wine is good and well balanced. It's crazy to put a lot of potassium. And when I began to work, after viticulture studies, my first vintage in 1978, I work with usual methods. And in 1983, the vintage was difficult. We had a big attack of Vert de la Grappe. It rained at the end of August. And for the harvest, the grapes had a lot of botrytis and icing. The pesticide and the antibotrytis is not a good solution. And in 1984, I spray Bordelaise bouilli, like my grandfather, with sulfate copper and show, with a pH with 9. And we are still using it, and I began to search alternative method of organic types. And at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, I had some friends who began in biodynamic, and I think it's very interesting. With many friends, we had the idea to produce compost together, and we founded the GEST in 1996. And Dominique Lafont was the first president. And now we produce a biodynamic compost together. At the same period with Chantal, my wife, we went to a biodynamic practice in organic school of Beaujeux in Beaujolais, and I began the biodynamy in my vineyards in 97 on two parcels, and we make 2 hectares in 98, 3 hectares in 99, and all the domain in 2000. So, today, I say conventional farming is not satisfactory because they work against the nature. But organic is good, we work with the nature, and from my point of view, biodynamy is the best because we help the nature. Yes. We work with a consultant, Pierre Masson. He works with a group of 10 domains. We are 4 in the IPNC, Dominique Lafont, Jean-Louis Trappet, Thibault Hubert, and me. And it's wonderful because we exchange and we progress together. We practice a performant biodynamy. We use humid preparation, hot rainwater, dynamizer in copper for avoiding electromagnetic pollution. And now, in Burgundy, we are studying some parcels, half organic and half biodynamic, and we are many differences. In organic, the structure of soil is good, After raining, the water isn't mired in the soil. But in biodynamy, the structuration is better. Water is mired with the soil. The flowers of soil are more intense, and we haven't erosion when we have a storm. The vines in biodynamy are more straight, and the pore of leaf is different, more airy, and the resistance to disease is better. We have difference in the wine. More balance, always a good acidity, a lot of fineness, more purity, and the digestibility seems better. When we practice sustainability, we use a lot of fuel, and we have important carbon emissions. For reduced carbon emission, last year, the GEST worked with a farmer for producing organic sunflower oil for the tractors. And now, in Burgundy, we have a local organic system, producer, storage, user. Organic sunflower is important, no fertilizer, and avoid OGM. It's possible to use only sunflower oil with a kit of bicarbonation or blend with fuel. And the vegetable oils haven't carbon emission because it's not a fossil product. The recent tractors use more fuel than old tractors, and we find to adapt Pantone system for reduce use fuel. Pantone system adapt an échappement. There are a little water reserve in the échappement. This water boils and produces a gas. This gas is injected with the air. The consumption of fuel is less, and the combustion is better. We have less black smoke and particles. Today, in organic or in biodynamic wine, it's impossible to have good wine for keeping without sulfur. All the sulfur is produced by the industry, and I think it's necessary to charge volcanic sulfur for the wine. It's better for the wine and for the health. And in your glass, you have Volnay Limitant 2005, premier cru. Yes, O5 is a very, very good vintage, very rich, with a beautiful color, intense color. And we have a lot of aroma, very purity, very intense, and we have very silky tannin with a very good potential, and it's very the terroir produce a very Volnay with very balanced between aroma and equilibrium, and very harmonious. Yes, and you can taste when the wine is young, and you can keep for a long time.
Everyone, if you haven't tasted it, please taste that wine number one. For me, I think it's beautifully elegant, silky. It's got a lot of surprising sort of concentration that without being heavy or clunky. And I'm getting something that I get in a lot of Volnays, which is kind of a smell of, if you remember this from your childhood, modeling clay. I don't know if you remember playing with especially like the gray modeling clay and what your hands smelled like after you molded that. Not Play-Doh, which kind of smells weird, but like actual modeling clay. I really believe that's something that I always get on this particular terroir, as well as a little bit underneath the fruit, which is quite dusky and a little spicy, but I also get a little bit underneath of a rooty component. And when I say roots, I mean sort of root vegetables, but almost rich ones, like, sort of beets after they've been roasted or something. So there's that element of earth that's there. And I got yesterday a little bit on this today as well, a tiny bit of sassafras root, if you're familiar with that. Doesn't push you quite in the direction of licorice, but similar. And it's just a little bit more weedy and green. And a little bit more exotic, almost like the kinds of roots that you would use or that French monks would use to make an exotic liqueur or something. So I think it's very, very young and you know, will show much, much more in the future as well, but a beautiful, beautiful wine, really special. Did I understand you right that you were saying with the tractors you fuel them with a vegetable oil type of fuel? Is that what you were saying? Did I get that right?
Yes, it's sunflower oils, and it's important the tractor begin to fuel, and when the engine is hot, you pass on the oil, sunflower oil.
Wow, yes. Quite and fascinating. And less emissions, you said, less smoky, less black smoke emission than from that.
Yes, and when you, before to stop, you pass on a fuel for a new start after.
Got it. Wow. So that's pretty cool. Let's move on to our next one here. Okay. Ted. Will talk to us about his path to sustainability and their approach at Literai Wines, and also take us through the wine, if you would.
Good morning, everyone. I was a traditional, what I call chemical farmer or conventional farmer for many years. I had the opportunity to work in Burgundy for the first 4 years of my career and farmed conventionally there, which was precisely during the period of time that Dominique Lafont referred to, the period of time in the sort of early 80s when Dominique and Fred here, who were very kind to me and gave me lots of inspiration in my career, were beginning to say, wait a minute, what's going on with these chemicals? Maybe we shouldn't be spraying them. And I have done some consulting in Oregon also with Archery Summit. I work now in New Zealand. And I also became convinced, really towards the middle of the 1990s, that what we all call Western farming, the theory of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium supplementation to grapevines or any plant just doesn't work. And I became very frustrated, thought about becoming an organic farmer, and chose the path of BD because I felt just personally, and I think to a large extent incorrectly, but I felt personally that organic farming was substitution farming. In other words, I take, instead of putting on a synthetic form of phosphorus on my farm, I'm going to go and buy an organic form of phosphorus, but I'm still following that Western agricultural model, which I felt was failing me in my career as a viticulturalist. So we adopted biodynamics starting in 1998. That was the first vineyard that went BD for us. Everything we farm ourselves and all of the vineyards that we rent are farmed biodynamically. We encourage all of our growers to be organic, but I'm personally not motivated by certification. It really doesn't matter to us. So we're not interested in receiving the approval of any organization or outside body. We want the most important thing to be on our label, our name, and that's our certification of what we're trying to do and what we stand behind. I would like to just take a second, if I can, because I do think that we've sort of muddled through this question of what BD is, and I'd like to give you four definitions. I will jump on it. Dominique may kill me, but he can say that I'm completely wrong, but I think I can give you four things for you to go home with that would really help you to understand what this rather complicated subject is. So if I could just do that quickly. Perhaps the first and most important tenet of BD is that the farm should be perceived as a self-contained individuality. That is to say that the long-term goal is to create a farm that is entirely self-sustaining. It generates all of its needs and all of its inputs from within itself. It's a goal. This is perfection you're seeking. As we've talked about, sustainability is a path, but that's a very important concept for biodynamics. The second one, equally as important, is that the material world is nothing more than condensed spirit. That's a very important idea. Suddenly we're farming spirit rather than farming material. Now, if you just sit back, and I know a lot of you probably don't even have gardens, but just think of the implications of that for a farmer. I'm farming spirit rather than farming dirt. That's a big one. Then the third one, which Andrea just kind of sort of wrestled with, is the burying of the preparations, which are a bunch of materials which BD farmers put in the ground. The idea is that by putting these in the ground, you are enlivening them with cosmic, or if you want, spiritual forces, which when you bring those up and use those in your vineyard, enhances the spiritual dimension of your farm. And then finally, the other one that's very big is it's not just about the farmer or his farm. The last really important tenet of BD is that this enhanced food, this enlivened food, whether it be wine or vegetables, whatever, fruits, give humanity the forces to confront the challenges of our lives, be they the challenges at work, at home, in our marriages, or in the bigger plane of trying to figure out what we're doing here as humans on this planet. So this is a whole cosmological system that I think is something that takes, as Dominique implied, a very long time to grasp. But those four major tenets can give you something that can hopefully help you understand this odd term that we're throwing around today. Having said that, we chose this path and embraced it fully. I didn't believe in it at first, but I didn't disbelieve in it at first. I said to myself, we're going to try this. This is a farming paradigm, a different way of working the earth, and we are going to see if we can make it work for ourselves. And we've never looked back. We've enjoyed it thoroughly. It's been a wonderful personal voyage. I completely agree with both Dominique and Fred in that the vines really live in the year, in the soil. They experience their environment in a very different way than conventional or even traditional organic vineyards or plants do. So that's tremendously exciting for us. We hope it makes better wine, but my feeling is that's not my job to say. My feeling is I make wine. If people like it, that's great. If they like one that's BD, even better. God bless them, but I just do the best I can, and then it's up to the buyers or the tasters to make their choices. So we have been doing it for over 12 years now, and thoroughly enjoying the process, as I said. The wine I brought today is, in fact, one of our BD vineyards, which was planted following the tenets of biodynamics and has been farmed that way since inception. It's called The Haven. It's located about 3 miles from the Pacific Ocean, just south of the town of Jenner, where the Russian River meets the coast. So we're very close to the coast, high up, about 1,200 feet in elevation, fairly cool, one of the last vineyards we harvest. And we're thrilled with the results. We really think we see a difference in the way the plants are, as I said, living in their environment through BD. My descriptors for the wine would be dark fruits. I said yesterday, Morello cherry. There's a black licorice component to the wine. There's maybe some little Alpine strawberries. It's quite backward. It needs a lot of time to express itself. I think as you sit and listen to us this morning, you'll see the wine change over time. Good richness, I hope, and lots of tannins. So our expectation is that it'll last for many years. So thank you.
Fabulous. That was really, really helpful, especially the four tenets of biodynamics. Good. And it's a paradigm that when you read through those things and think about it, it seems just so applicable to life in general and to how we sort of treat ourselves and one another. It's quite inspiring. We will now move on to Nigel Greening from Felton Road, and let's talk about his path to sustainability and his approach.
Hi. The good news is that I had prepared something of a scientific lecture for you, looking at the nature of nonlinear dynamic systems and how chaos theory interrelates with sustainability.
Go ahead and drink the wine.
Yeah, I was advised that the average kind of alcohol blood levels that would sustain this morning really wouldn't see us through that, so we're not going to do that. I'd just like to quickly refer you back to the title of this session and this conference, Sustainability Without Sacrifice. And I put the following thought to you. Sustainability is the only way you can have something without sacrifice. By absolute definition, if it's non-sustainable, there will be a price to pay. There'll be a sacrifice. Maybe not you that pays it. It may not be now, but the bill will arrive. And we're all started coming to understand that. And so I think a very important starting point with all of this is to understand we have to be sustainable if we want things without sacrifice. At Felton Road, we are certified organic. We're certified biodynamic, which probably means we're certified insane as well. But I just pass this thought on. I'm not going to go in. Biodynamics is a philosophy, and everyone has their own angle on it. I find it intriguing that the organizers of this didn't set out to find a group of biodynamic farmers. They just wanted to find some people who they thought made good wine, who were thinking about sustainability. And it's a measure of how broad this whole school of biodynamics is becoming in the world of wine, that in picking a group of people around the world, pretty much all of them have adopted this approach. It is quite strange. It's kind of Harry Potter grows grapes. But if anybody wants to learn more about it, you know, come along at mealtimes and talk to one of us or something, because it's not really nearly as wacky as it sounds when you get down to it. I'm just going to give you a couple of anecdotes about our experiences within discoveries we've made with sustainability along the way within our vineyards. The first one is we have roughly 30 hectares of vines that we manage, but we've also got 30 hectares. Well, you've got the rough equation now. That's getting on for 100 acres. We've got another 100 acres of hill country, which I always used to say were too steep to grow grapes, but having just come back from the Mosel, I know that's nonsense. They're too steep for us to grow grapes anyway, and there's hundreds of thousands of acres of this country up where behind us. We own a bit of it, and it very quickly gets taken over by thorn bushes, sweetbriar, and all sorts of things like that. And traditionally, that's controlled by helicopter spraying with herbicide, and that's what the farmers who own most of that land do around us. We aren't allowed to do that because we're of our organic certification and we don't like doing it anyway, so we put a herd of goats up there to eat our thorn bushes. They're African meat goats from the Kalahari Desert. And when you look at our property, you immediately see how we have less of a problem than the guys who pay all this money for helicopters. And the thing that's terrific about it is the goats eat the thorn bushes and we eat the goats. I appreciate this might leave a little to be desired in terms of gratitude, but I can assure you it's a hell of a lot better than eating a Jet Ranger, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper too. And so that was a nice discovery we made. You didn't need to pay for helicopters and pay for chemicals and those things to solve your problems. You could actually get nature to do it for you. Second quick anecdote, as it comes up to vintage each year, Blair, who's around here somewhere, stores up all the worst jobs of his year, and about 2 weeks before vintage starts, he says, "Oh, Nigel, look, I'm a bit too busy now. Would you just take care of this for me and dump something awful on my desk?" And in this case, new regulations are coming up for wastewater. As in most countries, things get tougher and tougher with pollution levels, and our licenses for all our winery wastewater were coming up for renewal, and we knew that our next door neighbour was having to pay about $250,000 to put in new wastewater treatment. And so Blair kind of asked, would I go through this and bring in the experts and consultants and measure everything, see how much we'd have to pay to bring our wastewater systems up to scratch. And when I got into this and we started to look at the analysis and talk to the experts, to begin with, they thought there were some mistakes and kind of said, no, these figures can't be right. You're going to have to go back and look at them again because something's wrong. And they were just too low for the experts to get their heads around. And it took us all a while to understand what was going on and why there was so low counts in our wastewater. And this isn't a chemical thing. You might think, oh yeah, we don't use chemicals, so we don't have problems. It's nothing to do with that. One of the very, very important ethics in biodynamics is this idea of you have a self-contained farm. You sustain everything from the microbes to the people from this one piece of land. And so a very important part of that ethos is you don't waste. And we hold that it's just part of what we do in the winery. We don't throw anything away. Nothing goes down our drains. If it's liquid and it's in the winery, then it's wine and we sell it to you. We put it in the bottle and sell it for a lot of money. If it's the biggest single point of waste in a winery, it's normally the lees. And wineries generate huge quantities of lees. And often those lees go down the drain. In our case, we distill all the lees, or we have them distilled, and we make a fiend, a brandy, and we sell that to you for a lot of money. And if it's solid, we compost it, and it goes back in the vineyard. It includes all our office waste, all our food waste from the kitchen. There just isn't anything that gets thrown away. Blair has a sacred rule over the course of vintage, from beginning to end. No one person must lose, throw away, or in some way spoil more wine than they can drink at one sitting. And it's created this ethos. We don't throw stuff down drains. We don't have waste, so we don't have to spend $250,000 on a wastewater treatment plant. And it's a really good example of it. It's not just without sacrifice. It's sustainability with benefit. So that's really the second anecdote I wanted to share with you. Just talking quickly about the wine that's there. I was saying yesterday the French are so lucky because they have terroir, and in New Zealand we've only got dirt. And they have these wonderful names, you know, for their vineyards, Richebourg and Clos de la Roche, and we have Block 3. we're going to think up some better names. This wine is one of, I suppose, what we call our Grand Crus. It comes from a little subsection of one of our vineyards, Block 3 of Elms Vineyard. It's a sweet spot where the soils just really work with the vines. We don't make it any differently or grow it any differently to our other wines. It just happens. So, very simply made. We're very lazy winemakers. But all of us, I think it's very interesting, whenever you hear winemakers up here, doesn't matter where they come from in the world, you ask them how they make the wine, you get the same replies. And Jean-Luc Mayo from Burgundy, once when he was at our winery for his first time in New Zealand, and he asked about 20 questions, and then he just said, oh yeah, you do all this stuff, don't you? And, you know, it's the same world over. So we all make our wines pretty much the same way. 30% whole cluster for the geeks. Yeah, that's about it, really. So I hope you like the wine. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That is a beautiful wine, and it's interesting. We were talking about the cycles of the moon and the fruit days, and even from yesterday to today, the wines have evolved a lot and taste quite different to me. And this one has just blossomed beautifully, and I get a really beautiful sort of savory expression in it of almost Asian spice, and even just this bare hint of like ginger or fresh ginger or something like that. It really makes you want a meal, and a meal that you've thought carefully about, because it's quite special.
Can I mention one thing just very quickly? Sorry, I don't like to interrupt. There was quite a lot of laughter earlier when we were talking about tasting on fruit days. In the UK now, just about every significant trade tasting that happens is only done on fruit days. You'll get the invitation, it'll give you the date, it'll say below fruit day. So people are taking this stuff pretty seriously now.
After the difference between yesterday and today, I absolutely would do the same. Without question, I'm being serious. That's not a tongue-in-cheek comment. Now let's talk about the Bethel Heights and Ted Castile, your Bethel Heights winery here, right here, on the near corner, your approach to sustainability.
Okay. First of all, I have to admit, by the way, that I'm not a winemaker. I'm a grape grower. I don't know whether there's such a thing as a celebrity grape grower, but maybe I'm the first. I don't know. But I think I'm here today, why I was chosen, because my own personal history with sustainability is kind of interwoven with a rather unique organization in our industry, and in fact in the American wine industry, called LIVE, standing for Low Input Viticulture and Enology. It's a sustainability program and a certifying agency that certifies vineyards sustainable in Oregon, and now in the last couple of years throughout the Pacific Northwest. So to begin with my story, I've been farming wine grapes now in the Willamette Valley for about 30 years. I was trained at UC Davis back in the 70s. And I remember in those days they used to, on the weekends, take us out to these perfect vineyards in the Napa Valley, where we would be inspired and want then to become the kind of grape grower that would make the kind of vineyard that they were showing us. And there was one particular vineyard they took us to. I remember it had a long driveway, and what I liked about it was the house was right in the middle of the vineyard. Our goal as we left our old life was to bring the home life and the work life together. But in this particular case, as we drove into this place, there was only one thing growing on this large farm, and that was wine grapes. Broad-spectrum insecticides had killed all the bugs. Widespread use of herbicides had wiped out all the rest of the vegetation. There weren't any birds singing. It was sort of a Rachel Carson moment for me, and convinced me as a person entering farming from another life that that wasn't the kind of vineyard that I wanted to build. Well, shortly after that, my wife and I and our children moved to the Willamette Valley, to a place about 15 miles from here to the south, in the Ola Hills. And it was really like coming to the Garden of Eden. The Willamette Valley is a rather remarkable place. A tremendously diverse ecosystem. There are more than 200 horticultural crops grown here. There are virtually no insect pests that we have to worry about. We naturally have about 4 or 4.5% organic matter in our soils. Our soils at Bethel Heights, without any composting or whatever, are, you know, about 90% colonized by mycorrhizal fungi. That's a good thing. It's a sign of a healthy soil. So we were able, in other words, to grow wine grapes here. With the only input we ever did was in the early years was to spray 7 or 8 times for powdery mildew. And so we started our project and raised our family and enjoyed our life for about 10 or 15 years. And then in the early 90s, our industry started to change. More and more people were coming in as we became gradually over time, especially with the vintages in the late 80s, a fine wine region in America. And of course, people can visit here and visited us and decided to become part of it. And our industry, we started, there were 17 wineries in the Willamette Valley, and I think now there are about 350. So everybody came in, they piled on, and over time, a lot of rather foolish people decided to join our ranks, people who didn't understand about sustainable grape growing. And so finally, in the mid-90s, it was at the end of my tenure as the research chair for the Wine Advisory Board, I decided with a group of three friends to begin to form a sustainability group for our industry. The goal was really to create the kind of program that had a very positive pitch to it, that would engage the growers wherever they were in their journey toward sustainability, that had no decalogue of thou shalt nots appended to it, no metaphysics, a very practical approach that would engage everyone. And our goal was and remains today in the LIVE program to create a program and to sustain a program that will eventually be to certify really our whole industry sustainable. There are basically four fundamental tenets, and I think you kind of heard these things echoed today in the personal experiences of the other panelists, but they're basically these. First is the gradual reduction and elimination of all off-farm inputs. The kinds of things that we bring onto the farm from the outside world, like pesticides, diesel, plastics, all those things, the goal is to gradually, over time, eliminate them as part of our farming life. The second is the notion of biodiversity. That is, the way you avoid having to spray insecticides, for instance, is to not have a monoculture. And so what we insist upon are lots of different kinds of flowering plants growing around the vineyard, in the vineyard. Our vineyards look a little ruffled. They're not this pristine one thing's growing there kinds of places. Ecological compensation areas are also required as part of the program. And finally, well, not finally, this number three is the notion, of, again, of the whole farm. That is, the farm is an ecosystem that interacts with itself. You can certify an acre of carrots in the middle of a 300-acre farm, just the carrots. But then what happens right, when somebody, one of the other crops is treated with something that is not good for the carrots? Well, that becomes a problem. So, you know, even my wife, who happens to be here today, her garden is part of the certification process. The landscaping around our winery and an apple orchard that sits in the middle, we also have a cider house, all that has to be certified as part of the program, not just the wine grapes. And the final thing, I'm a little uncomfortable talking about this because some people here aren't certified, but because we were trying to certify an industry rather than just, you know, our own personal story, our goal and our belief is that certification is a very important part of sustainability. It's not just a question of being able to prove that you're not just talking the talk but walking the walk, but it also gives our growers a sense of rigor and discipline as they go about the actions that are part of sustainability. We insist people to keep records and all the rest of it. One of the reasons, a lot of corporations don't get certified is because they don't like sharing their records. In our industry, we insist on record keeping. We insist on monitoring for pests. If you're going to irrigate, you have to have a reason for doing it, all those kinds of things. So certification is part of what we're doing. And Bethel Heights wines, our estate wines, have all been certified live. Also certified by the IOBC, which is the international certifying agency that certifies live, and SalmonSafe, which is a Northwest certifying agency that certifies farms that have riparian areas where the water washes down into the Willamette and into the Columbia and threatens the Pacific salmon. About 1,200 acres signed on right away. We're now about a 15 to 17,000 acre industry. There was a period of time we kind of languished there, maybe for 5 years or so. And then I would say in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, there's been a kind of tilt that happened, and it happened all over the country. It's not just here in Oregon, toward a more sustainable life, people getting concerned about the food they were eating and all the rest of it. And so we have had a remarkable amount of success since then. Today, in our industry, we are either have certified or are people on the path to certification, 7,224 acres. It's almost half our industry. We also have certified or are on the path to certify more than half of the Walla Walla wine industry, which has become a partner with us. And just in the last couple of months, we have come to an agreement with San Michel, Chateau San Michel, more than half the Washington wine industry, in other words, to begin to certify their vineyards as well. So this has been a very gratifying thing that has happened over a period of time, has developed a momentum now, which I'm very proud to have been part of it and proud that our wines have been part of this program from the very beginning. The wine I brought today is our flat block. The flat block, the vines are 30 years old, own-rooted, Pommard, sits on a terrace on volcanic soils at about 600 feet. I like the wines from this block. It may not always get the highest scores of our wines. We make many different Pinot Noirs. But it always gives us a wine, I think, that tastes like Pinot, that has a more of a feminine, elegant aspect to it. And because the vines are older, I think they not only express the variety, but the place where the roots are. And a wine with a face, in other words, it's something more than Pinot Noir. And it's one of my favorites. And I think this 06 was a very hot vintage here, although we are in a cooler spot in the valley. So it's a little perhaps sweeter and more unctuous than it might be in a more normal year. But our flat block.
Very beautiful, I think. Tastes like Pinot, and specifically to me, Oregon Pinot. A couple of things that I get on it are things that I love when I encounter them in Oregon Pinot Noir. A little bit of pomegranate, which is both a savory and sort of a tangy element, as well as reminds me a lot of my grandma's strawberry rhubarb preserves that we used to make when I was little. So you get both the sweet strawberry and the zing of that rhubarb, and the two together are quite heady. It's lovely. Well, lastly, we'll hear from Michael Dillon from Bindi Wines in Australia, mate.
Australia. Mm. First of all, thanks for all being so patient. There's so much information that's been disseminated on the panel today. If you've all got heavy heads from last night, it would be compounding the problem. But when Ted was talking about the spirituality of biodynamics, I sort of looked around the room, and it's really hard to read people's faces because it's an interesting place to go. So I'll try and give you some interesting information, hopefully, on Bindi.
And, Elvis was a very spiritual person, by the way.
Only ate biodynamic deep-fried food, I'm sure.
Not enough. I think that's what ended up happening.
Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the hypocrisy of me sitting here talking about sustainability, having flown 15 hours on a jet aircraft from Australia. It's a pretty deep irony, I think, there. And also those heavy bottles, those deep punted bottles that the wine came around in, is something else that could be taken up. I know Jancis Robinson has quite a strong opinion on that, and she flies around the world telling people they shouldn't be using heavy bottles. So we all have deep levels of hypocrisy in our lives. Bindi is in the Macedon Ranges, 50 kilometres northwest of Melbourne in the southeastern corner of Australia. Obviously, the further south in the southern hemisphere you go, the cooler things get. And we're at 1,600 feet, 500 metres or so above sea level, so it's cooler again. So at Bindi, we just have Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Bindi's has been a grazing farm. It came into our family about 60 years ago, and it got split up when my grandfather died in the 60s. We're just half an hour down the freeway from the city of Melbourne, which is a bit over 4 million people. And our area basically doesn't have any farms now that exist on their own merits. It's mostly smaller holdings broken up as hobby farms or higher density housing around the local townships. And I think in our community there'd probably be three or four farms that really justify themselves on their own terms, i.e. what is produced on that farm pays the way of that family and looks after that farm. Mostly it's off-farm income sustains people's properties. So Bindi's a place that our family has a deep affection for. So for us, it's a real priority to be able to do something to look after that farm and make sure it's around in the long term for our family or even some other family, but just that it has its opportunity to exist in the longer term. On our farm, a 420-acre farm, we have just 16 acres of vineyard, and we have 100 acres of really important indigenous grasslands that we preserve. In the state of Victoria, over 99% of the grasslands have been destroyed either by housing or farming and various agricultural pursuits that really damage those grasses and replace them with introduced plants. So that's something that we just look after and nurture. We don't graze those grasslands. We just eradicate any weeds or noxious weeds that come up. It's not something we get subsidised for by the government or anybody. We just do it because we think it's the correct thing to do. We also have 100 plus acres of remnant bushland. In Australia, you get a lot of lovely farming land that has really old trees and then nothing. You know, it's either something that's 200 or 300 years old or 100 years old, and then everything else gets destroyed as it gets grazed or as it gets farmed. So we have these remnant bushlands that we just allow to sustain themselves. They revegetate. limbs of trees fall down, they break down, animals live there, insects have their habitat. And it's just another part of the biodiversity that we think that's important for us to maintain. Further on our property, we have a 35-acre tree plantation, a farm forestry project, which is indigenous hardwood timbers for long-term farm forestry, for furniture timber and flooring timber. And also in the shorter term, it allows us to have a good carbon offset for what we do. And I think it's important for us to take that step if we can, because increasingly and justifiably so, local forests are being locked up from forestry. And I think it's really important that the industries that have supported or have benefited from that forestry can continue, because there's a lot of people employed in that area. So for us, it's quite an interesting direction to take to be able to provide timber for that purpose, and that's something that we'll be doing increasingly where we have the opportunity just to create more forests of different timber types and create further diversity. So we like to think that our 16-acre vineyard exists in the sort of context of our farm, where there's other things going on that are the health of the general farm and not just purely about the vineyard. I have a strong thought that the vineyard really is a European impost on our indigenous Australian landscape. You know, it's grapevines aren't native to Australia. It's something that we bring in and we sort of impose on the landscape. And I think it's very important that we look after the rest of the landscape. And certainly within the context of the vineyard, we try and create a biodiversity. And the history of our vineyard is 20 years ago, my father wanted to do something with our property that would allow it to continue into the future, that would give it a possibility to make and to generate an income, and an income that had some margin involved. Obviously, it's a good value add to grow grapes and further turn them into wine. And that was his inspiration to do that. Back then, 20 years ago in Australia, the notion of the way of planting a vineyard and creating a vineyard was really to control the environment. It was more an environment of fear in the way you'd manage a vineyard. You didn't want things to be out of control. You wanted to control them. You didn't want to allow any maladies to occur in your vineyard. So you'd go out and you'd spray to keep the weeds down. You'd spray to keep disease out of the canopy. You know, you'd spray to keep botrytis away from your fruit. You just did a whole lot of things to control it because of the fear of something going wrong. And we sort of followed that path, and you know, it was reasonably successful for a while. And I think in a short context, those things can work and give you a result, but they're certainly not sustainable. And as Nigel was saying, you know, you just can't beat up on somewhere because it will come back and bite you. And we, about 10 years ago, started thinking, well, you know, do we need to keep doing a lot of these things just because? Is there a better way? So we started pulling things out. We started pulling out sprays into the canopy for botrytis. We solely used sulfur and small amounts of copper in the canopy. We certainly intensified the work we were doing in the vineyard by hand, so we had a more open canopy and a cleaner canopy. And we found the results were actually not just equal, but we thought the canopy was healthier. We thought the plant was healthier. And about 5 years ago, we started moving towards putting things in and enhancing the life in the vineyard. So, you know, using emulsions of fish and seaweed and manure preparations and trying to get a greater balance in the vineyard between the plant and the atmosphere, and mulching and composting. And we've found that our vines now have a greater resilience than they did previously. We've had a couple of really tough years in Australia. 07 was amazingly dry winter, and then very cold, dry spring, and a searingly hot summer. And we found that our vines were quite resilient to that. And then 08 came along, and it was an incredibly wet summer. We had the reverse. We had a very dry winter again, but then coming into 08, we had very high rainfall through the summer. And there was a great concern for us that, you know, we might have high disease pressure. And we found we had no botrytis, and we didn't have any mildews at all in the canopy. And I think that was because we were very diligent in our canopy management, but also I think the vines had a stronger resistance to this disease pressure. And because we're a small vineyard, we can get our timings right. And I think timing is really important. You know, if you get stuck on a sort of 10-day cycle of going out and hitting your vineyard just because, I think you miss a lot of opportunities to do things at the correct time, i.e. wait till bad weather's coming, get out there after bad weather's been, but not just have a prescriptive way, have a more interpretive way. And certainly for us, 08 was a really wonderful proof in that the resilience of the vine and the attentiveness of the management was giving a terrific result. It's interesting, taking away things that, you know, a bad and a deathly. It gives a really nice way of working in the vineyard. It's always nice to be out working with a plant and thinking that you're doing something to create life rather than imposing death. And I think Ted's point really strongly before about the whole spirituality of thing, it doesn't need to be a sort of a really hippie way out thing notion. It's more, for my mind, about a care and an affection for what you do and a care and affection for the place that you work in. And I know certainly I'd much rather have my children screwing up their noses at the stinky smell of fish emulsion than being exposed to sort of herbicides and pesticides and inhaling those very, very poor influences, really, because there's just no benefit from being exposed to chemicals if you don't need to. And you know, it's a positive thing to push the other way and really try and interpret a better way of doing things. Yesterday I heard Dominic talking about the importance of looking beyond just the vineyard in the way you do things, and Nigel certainly spoke really well about their whole farm and the way they maintain the effluents or the composting and the things that you're doing there and keeping things on farm. And at Bindi, we harvest all our own rainwater for our winery and our houses, and all our runoff water goes, you know, through a tree plantation or into grasslands areas. So it's all retained and created on the farm. Our electricity is all green harvested electricity. We're doing a new barrel room at the moment, and we prefer not to use air conditioning to keep our barrel store cool. So we cut our barrel room into the side of a hill, and further to that, we're drawing air from outside, running it through pipes to cool the air, and then running that through a ceiling cavity to moderate the temperature. And you know, it's just very simple things to do which save a lot of energy, and you can feel good about them. At the end of the day, you know, you're going to save on the bill, and it's a very positive thing to be doing. And I think if you have the opportunity to adopt something and be an early adopter and help develop that, it can be a really good inspiration for other people, and you know, it gives you that possibility to disseminate that information, that knowledge that you've gained, and it's a very inspiring and satisfying thing to do. There's one other thing. The things that Ted was talking about in regard to spirituality, there's a fantastic DVD it's a documentary on a guy called Peter Proctor from New Zealand who's just moved to India. And it's called One Man, One Cow, One Planet. And it gives a really lovely explanation about the way the biodynamic principles work in a practical sense, in a spiritual sense, and a community sense, about empowering people and taking them away from being victims of companies that, you know, push great sales and turn you into someone who is requiring their products at all points. It's a really wonderful video about empowerment. The wine. Wines are really interesting. Today, every wine to me tastes so much better than they did yesterday. It is absolutely remarkable. You know, I'm sitting here yesterday with our wine being asked to comment, and someone in the audience said, you know, can each winemaker really go through exactly what their wine tastes like? And I hate talking about my own wine in flavour profiles and structures. And I was, you know, just trying to be as positive as I could. Today, the wines absolutely sing. I think there's a real brightness of fruit in all of the wines and a greater structure that we're seeing. Today in our wine, I see lots of cherries and raspberry characteristics, where yesterday I just saw a more simplistic strawberry and cream character. And the volume on the palate today is definitely built more, and it's fuller and more powerful, more intense with greater length. So typically for us, the original vineyard is quite a perfumed wine. It's grown on quartzy alluvial siltstone soils over clay, and the wine is always very fragrant, very harmonious, almost delicate, whereas one of the other wines we make, which we'll see this afternoon at the tasting, is the Block 5, which is earthier, more robust, more tannic. So I'm particularly pleased with the way that wine's looking today.
Very, very. I totally agree with you. And I too, get an extra exoticism on it that takes me in the direction of sometimes those Chinese herbal preparations, like they're with elements of ginseng and gentian and echinacea that are really sort of exotic when you put them all together. When I first put my nose in the glass, I thought a whiff of like a eucalyptus character, but not that. It's not that level of intensity. It's much more that sort of Chinese herbal type of component, which I thought was very beautiful. totally agree with you about all the wines. I'm going to, Whitney, if today is still, lunch is still at noon today, right? So we can run over for a few minutes to incorporate Q&A because I think we definitely have it. This has just been quite fascinating and eye-opening, and I really appreciate everyone's efforts to illuminate the concepts as well as their particular approach to them. Very, very helpful. I think I wanted to play off of one thing that Ted said. Can you imagine the impact on health and healthcare costs and health insurance costs if we all had a discipline and rigor and even a certification around the habits that we have towards, say, diet and exercise? If we did that somehow in this country, it would be an extraordinary thing. I appreciated your pointing out this sort of element of discipline around that. Let's go to Q&A now, and I think that if we, as yesterday, we're going to have a microphone come around, and we've got a question right here in the middle. If you just give us a second to Oprah to get over to you.
Thank you. I'm interested in the proportion of new oak in each wine. I find a couple of the wines show a great deal of oak, and I just wondered how much new is being used. And what sort of toast, what comment might one make about the influence of toast and the ultimate oaky character of the wine?
Okay. Ted, can you tell us the proportion of new oak in yours?
No.
No.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I thought so.
He's the great grower.
My nephew might be able to.
Okay. Andy? 50% new oak. And at what level of toast? Is there a mix or... Medium toast, okay. And Fred?
I have in this wine 20%.
20% new?
It's a maximum for me.
It's a maximum?
It depends on the vintage, and it's between 12 to 20%.
12 to 20%, and in this great vintage, 20 was his, he went to the maximum. Ted?
50% on our wine, and actually... think that our wine shows more new oak than, or quote-unquote new oak than you might think. It's actually a very reductive wine, which is a kind of a technical term, but I would describe it as being more in that sort of lazy, or we say matchstick kind of quality. It's actually not really the oak, and I think as it sat, it showed less, but 50%. Medium toast, whatever the heck that means.
Right. and Nigel?
Yeah, about 50%.
Michael?
200% American high toast.
200% American high toast. All right, come back here.
Does it show? Anyone pick that? No, 30% new.
30% new.
Medium toast.
And medium toast. Okay, so very low, in all things considered. Okay, we have I guess I'll get to this one real quick because he's close, and then we'll go all across the room to the next one.
My question is about farming, especially in Burgundy, where there are a lot of plots right next to one another. You spend a lot of time and energy working on your piece of land to make it self-sustainable, but your neighbor is spraying everything possible from Monsanto all over his or her property. How do you deal with that sort of imbalance or, you know, compromising of your efforts?
It's a little problem perhaps, but if a big problem if we the neighbor spraying by helicopter, but it's not, I don't have this car, but my neighbor I speak with us, and if you don't spray with a big machine, with big sprayer, and be careful with me. And when I put a preparation biniamic, the first row of my neighbor have to.
Can I just inject here? We had this question yesterday, and Dominic gave the most fantastic answer. Yeah. So I just want to pass on what he said yesterday. He said this works the other way, because more often than not, actually what happens is we infect the guys next door who farm chemically, because they see how good our vines are, and they just want to do it the way we do.
Very cool. I think we had a question down here. Nope, changed your mind? Okay. We have another question right over here.
This is to Nigel. In regards to making the wine, you talked about the waste that you totally compost everything. I'm just wondering what you do in the winery as far as your cleaning solutions for sanitation practices. What do you use there, and how do you dispose of that material? Thank you.
Great question.
In terms of the fine technical detail of it, you probably need to talk to Blair. Essentially, we don't use anything particularly nasty within that. Probably the most aggressive chemicals that get used would be in kind of treatments of barrels and things, but they're volatile, essentially, kind of gas-based sulfuring barrels and things like that. There's nothing particularly nasty goes in there. I guess we've got a dirty winery. you'd need to talk to Blair about the details, so kind of collar him afterwards, or if there's a microphone anywhere near him, he could answer.
Blair, are you handy?
Yeah.
Forgot where he was sitting.
Yeah, he's there.
That'd be great.
Blair's going to kill you.
There's nothing. We just use a small amount of caustic soda. It's less than 15 kilograms per year relative to the amount of wastewater that goes out. I think it's pretty dilute. And also relative to the acids that we have in the wastewater, it's quickly neutralized. We're looking at going to using hot water and steam from a diesel-generated pressure washer to eliminate the use of the caustic soda. Then there'll be nothing used.
Anybody else on the panel have anything to add to that? I think we've kind of... okay, great. Another question? We have one in the back here. Just one second.
Oprah's coming. It's the white Oprah.
Thank you. I have a question regarding CO2 output. As winemakers, one of our largest impacts on the environment may be our production of CO2 during fermentation. It's my understanding by volume, a ton and a half of grapes will produce 40 times their volume of CO2. What I don't have a very good understanding on, and maybe someone in the panel or in the audience might be able to help us understand how much CO2 is taken up by an active canopy growing grapes. Maybe, per cubic foot of canopy, we're absorbing so much CO2 throughout the year.
There's a very, very simple answer to that, none whatsoever. It's a closed cycle. The CO2 is captured by the vine to make the fruit, and it's then released during fermentation. So all the sugar that creates the CO2 when it's turned to alcohol, is the CO2 is embedded in that sugar by photosynthesis as the grapes are growing. So no CO2 is generated by fermentation whatsoever. It's a closed loop.
So you're saying it's a contained system?
It's an absolutely contained system. It's a common myth. I've seen CO2 calculations for wineries, how much you generate fermentation. It's a very commonly misunderstood point.
Great, thank you.
There's some interesting work done, and I'm not a policy wonk, so I can't cite the paper, but there was, in fact, a couple years ago, I think it was at UC Davis, an interesting paper done on CO2 capture by grapevines looking at vineyards, and the CO2 trapping is about 80% of what a forest is. So it's quite high.
Dominique had an input for this topic, too, as well.
Just also to add something, you also drink a lot of that CO2 because there's 600 to 800 milligrams of CO2 per liter in wine, usually, so you consume it. You have it. You have a big part of it.
Don't burp.
No waste. One more time. We sell it to you for a lot of money.
Wait a minute. There's something wrong here. The Burgundians are learning this trick from the Kiwis, the money thing.
Another question. I think we have one over here.
Well, thank you so much, and congratulations to the entire panel. My question goes to Mr. Dillon. I'm just really very amazed at the holistic approach that you're taking in growing your grapes, including eucalyptus plantation. It sounds like you're using the eucalyptus even for phytoremediation for your waste. I'm curious, do you have your wood plantation FSC certified, and are you incorporating any kind of wood product back into packaging for your wines?
What was the certification you mentioned, please?
For Stewardship Council.
Right. No idea. No, we just... In the state of Victoria, we have a reasonably proactive government who have been providing a lot of education about the opportunities for farmers to regenerate damaged landscapes and also just put in forests to replace those that are being locked up and provide an alternative timber source. And for us, it was just simply something we thought was a good idea to do. It's a long-term thing. That was my father's inspiration, as was the vineyard. I haven't got much to stand up here for, have I? No, it was his decision to do that, and I think it's for him it's a whole part of being on the farm and the continuity, and that's a sort of 40-year project that he won't be around to see fulfilled, but it's something that I will embrace and something that you know, his grandchildren will benefit from. So I think there's a whole lot of boxes that ticks as to why it's a good thing for us to do on our place. But yeah, I mean, I get a lot of pleasure from that because it's just another dimension and another complexity and a very positive complexity for us.
I have another question here.
This is for Nigel. Gives you a moment to think quickly. I interrupted your dialogue on chaos theory yesterday and squeezed in a question about bottle weight, and you waxed poetic on lowering the weight of the bottle for lower cost in shipping, and I just wondered if by using less energy for shipping, has this been cost effective? Have you had any breakage? Has the thinner bottle in any way affected the longevity of your wine?
No. Well, the short answer is we do use the lightest bottles we can get. Interesting equation here. We can grow the grapes, make the wine, allow for the carbon cost of the bottle, all the packaging, closure, ship it to America, do that entire equation for less CO2 cost than the cost of making one of those heavy, deep-punted bottles. So sorry about that. The bottle, to give you a rough idea, we can get a grow, make, package, and ship a bottle of wine for around 600 grams of CO2. The bottle we use, which is the lightest bottle we can get, about 270 grams to make, and one of those nice big heartbreak bottles, as they're known, because you still think they're full when they're empty, uses normally around 600 to 700 grams to make. So, it's the wine's no better in a heavy bottle than a light bottle. It just feels that way. So, everybody, please. You know, people put the wine in big bottles because consumers like it. So as consumers here, you know, just go along with us when you give you the wine in a lighter bottle. In the UK now, I'm obliged to tell all our merchants, and Jasper knows this because I supply wine to Jasper and you do it, I have to give them the exact weights of the bottles, the carbon cost, the exact weights of our packaging, everything. We have to audit it, give that information to Jasper, and he has to pass that on himself. So it's a system we're used to in the UK now.
Fascinating. Take one more question over here.
Could any of you comment on the sustainability of the cork industry and your thoughts towards alternate closures?
Any takers?
I just don't want to hog the microphone. I've got plenty to say on the subject.
I have a lot of information on that, but it's certainly something that we as an industry have been tossing around for a while. How sustainable is a natural product like a cork versus a screw cap? A cork with the foil on the top, sort of a trade-off. There are now sustainable cork forests, I think, in France and in North Africa that people are, in our industry, beginning to source from. I know that, but that's about as deep as I get. I'm sorry.
There's just a couple of quick things I'd like to mention. The carbon cost of a cork is lower than that of a screw cap. It's lower by roughly the amount of CO2 you use to move a car about 4 feet. So it's not a huge amount, but it is lower. What it isn't is lower when you allow for the carbon cost to make the wine and the packaging and the shipping of the bottles you throw away. And that's what the cork industry don't factor into their calculation. A quick thing I'd like to say here, the cork industry have made a huge thing in Europe about how if the cork forests end, it'll be a tragedy for the Iberian eagles for whom they're the natural habitat. Anyone who's been to the cork forests knows full well that they're not going to be turned into parking lots or swimming pools if they're not used for wine closures. They will still be used for cork for other purposes, apart from anything else. And they were just the same as the oak scrub forests that were there before they got used for cork, and they'll still be there afterwards, whether they're used for wine bottles or not. So.
One more burning question, and then we'll wrap it up. We had one over here. I'm sorry, did I miss somebody?
Was there a question?
Okay.
Just a question here for Fred.
Okay, we'll do two more burning questions then.
I have a question for Frédéric Lafarge. Bionomy is a complete system including animals. Do you have animals in your vineyard?
Yes, I have a chicken because, we go in the vineyard with the chicken, and I have this idea in 03 because in spring 03 we have a lot of insect and the insect eat the bud, and now with the chicken and during the pruning and the chicken grow out and eat the little insect, and we don't have a problem, and it's very very nice to work with the chicken in the vineyard.
So in America it's vineyard dogs, and in France it's vineyard chickens.
And in Australia,
and we eat very good egg.
Yeah.
And in Australia we have about 400 kangaroos on our farm that graze often in the vineyard. We can be pruning vines and three or four rows across there'll be three or four, five, six dozen kangaroos just happily grazing. So, which is nice to think about that in Australia for you guys, I'm sure.
Very cool. Very cool.
One quick question for the panel right here. Sorry. I was wondering, I had a question on Ross Cobb from Cobb Wines in Sonoma Coast. I thought corks were a sustainable product because when I visited, the cork trees actually only harvest the outer
bark.
Part of the bark every 7 years. So it's actually not cut down like some people might think.
Right.
So it is sustainable forestry. But the second question I had for Nigel, I studied sustainable agriculture at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm very familiar with the biodynamic techniques and Pascal Marchand and some very inspirational people that are very involved in the biodynamics. But for me, I have a hard time. Some people might have a hard time with biodynamics because of the spiritual aspect of, or maybe more of the astrology side. But I understand 90% of it. But sometimes I get a little bit alienated. The question I have for Nigel is in the integrated wine growing certificate. Could you tell us really briefly about that? Because something that we don't have here in California, nor do we have something that Oregon has, the LIVE, and I'm interested in networking about that.
Okay. I'm probably not the right person to ask about this. Felton Road resigned from the integrated wine production system in New Zealand. It's a sustainable wine growing certification process. We resigned because we felt the standards were so low we'd be ashamed to have the sign on our fence. So I want them to. I just want them to set the bar higher, and they would like to be inclusive. This is the dilemma. You know, you want more people in, so you make the standards easier to achieve. And I think we have to start with a pretty high bar because I think the problems are significant. So it does include all those factors that people have talked about, winery, energy consumption, and taking a holistic approach, packaging, all of these things. It's a good scheme. It's just not rigorous enough.
So we will, in order to give you time to, with minimal carbon impact transit, because you'll be walking to lunch. We need to just wrap up a couple of housekeeping details. I want to thank this extraordinary